Hello, and welcome to Benyo Chats. If you're curious about the world, this show is for you. What is most misunderstood about escort work? On this episode, I speak to Ayla. There's occasional profanity in this podcast and adult themes, which makes this conversation unsuitable for children. We have a fascinating chat on the challenging questions Ayla asks, her strict Christian upbringing, and why is she so passionate about homeschooling, her thinking about rationality and enlightenment, and why she is a cam girl. If you enjoy the show, please like and subscribe, as it helps others find the podcast. Thank you. Be well. Hey, everyone. I'm super excited to be speaking to Ayla. Ayla is perhaps most famous on Twitter for shining a light on the life and economics of cam girls and escorts and asking challenging questions. But her independent research is larger than that, has encompassed reporting on LSD and psychedelic use, circling, the nature of faith and enlightenment. And she discusses many viewpoints of the rationalist community. And I find her work fascinating. Welcome.
Oh, thanks. That was a lovely intro. Thank you.
You're welcome. First question, what do you think is most misunderstood about sex work?
Most misunderstood. I mean, it depends on the kind of population you ask, but probably like a very common one is that there's no emotional component, or that like guys just want to get off and then they hire a girl and then there's no sort of like additional importance beyond just the physical expression.
So that it's not just a transactional thing, there's actually more to it.
Well, I mean, it is, I mean, it depends on how you define it, but it is very transactional, but like the thing that's being transacted is more than just sex. Like there's a lot of additional needs that men tend to have that is very common to get fulfilled with sex workers specifically, because the men who don't have those needs go and watch porn, right? Because with porn, you don't need sort of this live interaction to the same degree. And so the men who actually tend to seek out live sex workers tend to also have like additional desires that they want fulfilled, like emotional intimacy.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense to me. Oh, but that's also partly because I've read your guide, which you've written recently, to escorting, which covers pricing, marketing, safety, analytics, all sorts of great practical advice. But it's also part essay, I found, and you had a section on what I think you called the heart, or the heart of escorting. And I'm intrigued about this heart because it's not maybe quite what I might have expected. And critics might suggest perhaps there's a bit of romanticization in it, but I think your reflection seems true to me that there is actually more meaning in sex work. There's the emotional part and there's the other part of all of that. I'm always just wondering, I mean, how true it is from your experience and what you've seen in the wider community, and maybe you'd want to reflect on the kind of that heart of escorting work.
Yeah, I think it depends per person. Again, most of my answers are going to be hedged like that. But I think for me, I have the ability to sort of have like love in this way because I'm so compartmentalized about escorting. Like when I escort versus not escort, like in it's almost like there's two separate me's that do it. Like there's the escort me and then the not escort me. And there's like a mode that switches. And that feels like very protective, right? Like when I'm in that mode, I don't have to worry about like feelings or what this means, or like if I'm making a good decision about sex work, right? It's just like, it's a job. I become job mode. And then when I'm in that job mode, I feel like sufficiently insulated from like the, like from my personal self, that I feel like it gives me the freedom to be able to like really bond with these men in some ways. Like a part of me is like, hey, I feel like safe enough to sort of like be vulnerable in some way with them. And so for me, I really enjoy that. I enjoy looking for the ability to be vulnerable with men. Some of them don't feel like they give me very much of an opening. Like it's if it seems like they really want me to be something, but I like looking for it and taking it where I can find it. And some people are really good at doing that. That's me specific. A lot of escorts like don't feel the same way. Other escorts have different ways they approach compartmentalization. Some don't compartmentalize. Some find like a lot of effusive, sort of like bonding vulnerability without having to do the compartmentalization thing. So it's different for everybody.
Sure. But for you, there's kind of, I guess, like a persona as well in this compartmentalization, or is it just another version of the you that you think is you?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the difference is, right? Because, like, I feel like we are sort of our environment in some way. Like, if you put me by my parents, I become like an unrecognizable person. And if you put me in front of a crowd, like, I change. And it's not like I'm like, okay, I'm going to become like crowd Ayla or like parents Ayla, right? Like, it's sort of a reaction to the incentives in the environment. And so it's like a natural sort of response to optimizing for like the situation you're in. So yeah, like the Ayla that escorts is very different. And I wouldn't say it's like a conscious persona in some way. It's just sort of, it's an organic persona. It's like just what happens when I'm in that situation. Yeah, and it is very different from this Ayla. Like I have like body language changes and, you know, my tone of voice changes. I sound a little bit less nerdy and a little bit more feminine. But yeah, but I don't consider any less real in some way. I am like self-protective in some way, but I wouldn't consider it like not genuine or something. Yeah. I mean, I am dishonest sometimes when escorting. Like if somebody asks me like what they think of their penis, I sometimes am very dishonest about it. But in general, yeah.
Yeah. And that's presumably because you're always flattering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or sometimes even the opposite way. Like sometimes guys have really big dicks or very insecure. And I realized like, if I try to tell them that their dick is really big, they're not going to believe me. So I have to like act chill about it. Like, yeah, it was like, it's like pretty good. So it's dishonest in both directions. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's quite subtle. Yeah. That completely makes sense to me. Cause it's a little bit like, I always say it on Christmas dinners or, you know, festive seasons. This is where often you're trying to be two people at once. Like if you're trying to be a girlfriend and a boyfriend and a good son or daughter, and that's it. And so you flirt because you aim to play the daughter and you aim to play the girlfriend. And often that's kind of conflicting personas slightly. And so that's why actually I think you get so many arguments at those sort of things, because people end up trying to play two or three things at once. And at a point in time, you sometimes can't be those two things. So something slightly cracks and you get all of these arguments. And
that's a really fascinating theory.
Yeah, and you can see it. You see it, and you often, like, the outsider will see it with close family. Like, if you're invited to a family gathering or for whatever, and then you can kind of see it because you can see them, okay, their boyfriend, girlfriend there, but now they've been dragged away, and now they're having to try and be the son, and they've got different pressures. But you can actually almost see the tension in, uh-oh, what do I say? Because I would normally say this in front of my parent, but I would normally say this in front of my partner, and it all kind of splinters.
Huh. I'm gonna have to pay close attention to that. I'm about to go to a large extent family gathering, so
yeah, you could see that.
I will use your theory.
Yeah, particularly with those who you know well, and go, you know what, you've just been this other person, and now, you can't evolve both of those personas at once. Huh. That kind of leads me on to you seem utterly brilliant at asking questions, and your questions are awkward, challenging, silly, funny, deep, and kind, and they range from your surveys and polls to your dating form. And I was just wondering, how do you think of your questions? And you seem to have so many, you're probably not in danger of running out, but they just occur to you? Or is this how your mind works in the curiosity of what makes people people?
I guess it's the way my mind works at this point. It's just such a habit now. I mean, really, I feel like the question is, why is everybody else not doing Twitter polls? Like, yeah. To me, it feels like the obvious, or like coming up with like questions all the time. Like, to me, it feels like the obvious thing that everybody should be doing, because of course. And then sometimes people ask me like, why do you do questions? And I'm like, why is that the question?
Like, why aren't people doing more questions? Is everyone else is weird. I'm the normal one here.
I know. I'm the normal one. Yeah. I'm not sure. I like a lot of my tripping or something, like the, a lot of the themes around this were like finding the right question. Like, it wasn't so much about finding the right answer to your questions, but rather like figuring out how to look in the right direction, because like a lot of our questions are sort of hedged in by what, like the invisible norms that we have in the society around us that we can't even see. And so like to me, like new curiosity feels like it's an indication of like poking at the invisible walls. And it's like almost not the point what the answer is. Like, the point is the poking. And so I really get a lot of thrill out of that. And I don't know how to really answer for why I seem to do this more than other people. Part of it is Twitter, like the fact that I do have a very fast like response thing. Like, if I'm having a conversation with somebody and you're like, man, I wonder if people who are more agreeable tend to be firstborns more. Like, we can just check that really fast through Twitter. And so I think like having that really fast feedback thing like helped increase the amount that I think about Twitter questions. And by Twitter questions, I mean by proxy questions in general. So that was also very useful.
And did you have that as a teenager as well? Or did that develop as you kind of came onto Twitter as well?
I think it developed on Twitter. I do think that I was very into questions when I was a teenager, but not in the same sort of manifestation. Like, I'm like right now, the manifestation is social questions, like what generates sort of interesting social confusion or like social conflict. Whereas as a teenager, it was more like figuring out philosophical questions that I didn't really register as being socially controversial.
Sure. Actually, and if anyone listening is interested in questions, you can go to askcole.io, I think. And yeah, actually, there's a bunch of questions there, and you can buy the questions, or I think you can even.
We're out of stock, but
okay.
But we do have it downloadable for free.
And there you go. Find out more of that. I think there's at least over 100. I have skimmed them all, and we might ask a couple of later. So that also kind of leads me to think, because you're known as well for a lot of your rationalist thinking and being a part of some rationalist communities. Does that, as also an outshoot of your questioning and curiosity, or how did you fall into rationalist thinking?
A long time ago, I dated a guy who kept sending me Less Wrong articles. And I was like, whatever, I'll read it later. And then I started reading it. And then they have like interlinks, and I started following the interlinks. And then then it was no going back from there. I suspect it falls really close into the questioning thing, because like there's sort of an orientation that not just a lot of people have, which is like sort of like decoupling your moral response from like questioning a thing. A lot of people in the rationalist community used to be religious. Like I used to be very religious, and I had this sort of wake up shock. I'm not sure if you've ever had like a very radical mental change, but realizing that a lot of things that you took for obviously granted that were tied into your moral sensibilities were actually wrong. Like I used to be disgusted by gay people, I'm embarrassed to kind of say that about me in the past, but like it was really genuinely felt like, oh, I'm horrified by the fact that people could, like two men could kiss each other. Obviously this is immoral. And so that turned out to be wrong. I no longer have that moral disgust response. But now whenever I do have a moral disgust response, I'm like, well, I can't trust that. Like once one was proven to be incorrect. And so I think this is like driven by the questioning, this curiosity, like curiousness about your disgust response. Like, where is that really coming from? Like, does that hold up if I like change the circumstances in various ways? So like asking a lot of hypothetical questions about how does your moral intuition handle this alternative world or this alternative world? So it like really tests to see like, is this just sort of something people told you to feel and now you're feeling and it feels like your own? Because so much of what we feel feels like our own. But anyway, this is something that the questions do very well, but also rationalists are very interested in doing, very interested in like sort of sussing out exactly why we think about the world and what is justified.
I hadn't appreciated that in some ways it is a counterforce to being, like you say, a lot of rationalists used to be very religious, already had a set of values tied into them, and that there's been a complete change. And therefore, actually, you can question everything because something that you took as a kind of 100% truth, when you learn that actually you don't think it's 100% truth more, would then you can then question everything, which was 100% truth. And I didn't appreciate that about
I suspect it's thinking. Similar to psychedelics too. Like psychedelics do the same thing where they sort of knock out things that you thought were true a little bit. Like they shake the foundations of your belief, which like generates a lot more questions and like questions about who you are. A very similar principle, I think.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, that's another strong strand in your writing, investigate spirituality and enlightenment. You've got these set of enlightenment sort of interviews and research that you're continuing to do. And although I can kind of see it now, it almost seems to me that that's potentially a conflict with a kind of rationalist point of view looking at that, but I can kind of see, well, actually, if you take the rationalist point of view that it's questioning, then maybe not. But I was interested, why such a deep fascination there, and what have you learned, or are you learning from interviewing so many kind of self-confessed enlightened people, or people who feel they've reached that this a certain level of spirituality or thinking there?
The interest in spirituality came, well, I had like some strong spiritual experiences and pretty isolated from like the spiritual memeplex. Like there's a sort of like maps that people have made about like what spiritual experiences mean what and where they land and like what comes before and after. And I had gone through my sort of thing kind of independent of this. So it looked a little bit weird. And it also, I had no idea what the fuck was going on with me in regards to the way that other people understood it. So I started talking to some like prominent meditators about this to sort of get insight. And then eventually I just talked about other things, and then I started hearing them disagree with each other. I talked to one monk who told me that another like a very famous meditator was like totally full of bullshit and like thought that they knew what like the progression of meditation was, but like had no idea. And then that made me really fascinated. I was like, wow, okay, so there's something going on like in like the spiritual realm or whatever, but everybody seems to have very strong opinions about it and in different directions. So that made me want to figure out what people meant by the word enlightenment. I use that word as like a hook, but I mean, I kind of explored a lot of things close to it, like awakening or stream entry. And so I asked people, like, what is your experience with this sort of, and people have done this before, but I kind of wanted to come at it like outside of the spiritual memeplex, because I'm like mostly untainted and I kind of try to like protect myself from exposure to that, just to see if the kinds of patterns that I organically observe happen to align with what already exists, or just to put my own spin on it. I don't know, to see if I can detect my own patterns. So yeah, I talked to a bunch of people who claim to be enlightened to try to figure out if there was anything, how they disagreed with each other mainly.
So that's almost like a rationalist framework approach to it, or does it not square with your rationalist thinking as well? Is it a completely other thing for you?
Well, it depends what you mean by rationalist. It's like rationality is a practice of like attempting to minimize bias and make like predictions. And the enlightenment thing is pretty hard because it's sort of outside of the realm of predictions. Like you can't like enlightened people like don't make predictions better than other people, right? So it's sort of outside the scope of rationality to some degree. And a lot of rationalists do look down on, like they consider this to be an irrational thing, like coming out of a lot of biases. So there's some disagreement there inside of the rationalist community. But definitely like like for example, one concept of rationality is that like the word, the map is not the territory, the word is not the concept. Like we're using these references to these this landscape of concepts. And a lot of people get attached to the concepts and the words. Like when I first got into rationality, I was pretty like tribalistic and I was anti-feminist. And I was like, I once asked somebody like, are you a feminist? You know, like sort of wanting to know, like, am I going to be an ally or not? And the person responded, this was a rationalist, being like, I don't know what you mean by that word. Like what sort of actual concepts? And that sort of this is rerouting from like the sort of like performative layer into like, what are we actually talking about? They're like, name the concrete thing and I'll tell you if I support it or not. And that was like, and so there's something like this, that was a rationalist skill that I took to the enlightenment thing. Like, I'm not looking to find out like, is it or isn't enlightenment? Like, is this just a word that people are using to refer to a landscape of concepts? And my interest is the concepts, not the word. Like I give a fuck about the word. So that would be an example of the way that like rationality related to that sort of inquiry.
Yeah, okay, that's really interesting. Cause I viewed that sometimes rationalists seem to me, I'm not super close to the communities, there's not as large a community here in London in the UK, but potentially a little bit narrow in where they look at because of that, and they're therefore not as rich as those who actually look beyond that. But like you say, some of it is maybe beyond the bounds, and I hadn't quite appreciated your point about the map and the territory of that. Well, actually, you've got to try and name and articulate the thing and then know about, are we talking about the same thing or not just the word on it. And is that then intersectional about what psychedelics and other things have taught you? Because you've taken quite a lot of psychedelics and for like quite a period. And that again seemed to be quite an eye-opening or pivotal point in your kind of life and thinking. And is that kind of like a third pillar, or does that interweave with how you're thinking about sort of rationalism frameworks and how you're thinking about your life?
I'm not sure. A third pillar like psychedelics, rationality, and what was the third?
Well I guess was this kind of enlightenment slash you know, interest in that sort of otherness. Or kind of faith spirituality part, however you want to name it. I was just thinking that psychedelics initially, at least in my thinking, was perhaps again something slightly apart from rationality, quite hard to explain. Mm-hmm. You've got very personal and different experiences. You know, the framework for talking about it is quite tricky, doesn't seem to fall into a rationality framework that easily. Or maybe I'm mistaken and that actually you were going to explain to me how it might fit in quite neatly. I was just kind of intrigued because you've written quite well about it in terms of your essays and quite open but articulate it quite well, so I was just kind of fascinated by your experience really.
I would say the psychedelics for me are quite tied into the interest in spirituality. Like my spiritual experiences I think were a direct result of my heavy psychedelic use. A lot of rationalists are I just had like a moment of delight. Like, I don't think I've ever been on a podcast where people ask me about the intersection of rationality and like psychedelics. This is so cool. Sorry, that aside.
I'll try and make it into your top three podcasts ever then.
serious points for the novelty here. Normally it's just like what do girls do to get more money on OnlyFans? Like, right. That's usually the okay, but yeah, it was so a psychedelic, let's see. There's a lot of like distrust about psychedelics in the rationality community, but I think that this comes from like a chronic like misstep of like failing to see that you doing the thinking is part of the thinking. There's sort of the separation of like, I'm going to figure out the truth, like me and the truth are separate and I'm going to like discover it or something. And then there's some like subtle mental move that people do where they sort of like don't consider like the sensation of having a concept to be part of that concept, like almost like a creation of that concept. And so that's like where some of the, I think the schism comes in with like rationality and psychedelics and spirituality. But for me, I got into psychedelics before the rationality, which maybe was a good idea. I'm not sure. But it worked out really well for me.
Yeah, well, both aspects seem to sit well within you, and well, you talk about compartmentalization, but they do seem to coexist quite nicely, or at least in your essays and things. Maybe thinking about that, and on the rationality part, so a lot of rationality community people to me seem to be quite into EA, effective altruism type mm-hmm. ideas as well, and actually that expands often into a lot of them seem to me to be not only give away their money, say, but also into vegan and vegetarianism. Is that something which has interested you in that part, or are you kind of like, well, that's a sort of expected value things on moral decisions and doesn't really compute as well with you?
When I was taking psychedelics, I became a vegetarian for 2 years because I developed empathy for animals and all that. And then eventually stopped being a vegetarian when I decided that I was okay with killing. But that's like a more difficult thing to explain. I support EAs in general. It seems like they're doing like a good thing for the world and mostly having fun doing it. And probably not. Huh?
But do you consider yourself an EA yourself?
No, really. I don't. No.
Yeah.
No, they're too, they were, they're like, I maybe it's just like uncharitable, but I view them as like a little too uptight.
Right.
For me. I like being a little wild and controversial and like taking my clothes off, and they're the kind that like wears suits and tries to look nice.
And are there many rationalists then like you? There's a kind of wild subpopulation of rationalists as well, is the kind of nerdy EA types.
There's the post-rationalists, which is like a little bit of tongue-in-cheek
right.
term for rationalists who like rationality, but also like being embodied and doing weird things with their brains.
Sure. Okay, well, actually, this maybe is a good point to ask one of your own Ask All questions, which is, which of your habits conflicts with your values? And I've been thinking more and more the fact that for me, eating meat is probably one of my moral failings, thinking that I actually think that I probably should, or I believe that we should treat animals better, yet I could probably not eat them, and I do, although I'd be completely fine. In fact, I have done killed to eat and that sort of thing. I'd kind of be okay as a hunter-gatherer. I'm not living in a city. But I don't know what it might be for you. Are any of your habits, you think, really in conflict with your values?
Probably the same, maybe the meat-eating thing. But part of the thing is, like, I have, like, quite a bit of self-compassion, so I don't really feel, like, that much in conflict that often. I mean, occasionally I do. But like with the meat eating thing, like I've like come to terms with it. It's also like an indication of like compassion for other people who do like horrible things. Like so much throughout history, people were like, man, it would be moral. Or like you could imagine them saying it. It'd be moral like not to have slaves, but it's just like so inconvenient. And so like if we can do this on like a very small scale and it feels like good and normal, like it really, it shows like how the other people who've committed atrocities in the past were also like very human and doing very reasonable things.
Yeah, that's very true. I think this is one of the things about the time we are living in, or considering all the time, like slavery is quite a good example. Like if you go back 300 years or so a fair amount of time, but or maybe even only 150 or so years, and you said you were anti-slavery, you would have been the weirdo, right? You're in the minority and you would have find it tough going. So I think, you know, today I'm still quite sympathetic for these minority and weirdo views, because I'm not certain exactly which of the ones are going to turn out to be the ones we view as very moral, you know, today. Mm-hmm. You anti-slavery, that's a thing, but 200 years ago, I'm not sure everyone would have necessarily come to that position.
Yeah, there's a thing where I feel like I wish we had more of a focus on like argument archaeology, where we focus on like the arguments for horrific things at the time, like things that were widely accepted. And like, what was the discourse like? People were obviously talking about this and making like arguments for the horrific thing. And so like, there's like arguments like against women's rights and pro-slavery that are like really like kind of, you know, quote unquote, like, well, seeming to be clear for those listening, I do not actually endorse slavery. I do not find the arguments to be valid. But if you like were at that time, like you weren't educated really in like moral whatever, if you didn't like think really hard about it, like they seem really, really convincing. And I wish that people kind of were aware that people like didn't commit atrocities just like randomly because they were bad, but that they were like held up by like these arguments that seemed really good. And it just seems so important for like our understanding of current moral issues. Like right now, we're probably going through several atrocities that we're not really aware of that are propped up by arguments that we consider to be really good.
Yeah, and that's exactly the point. In fact, going on the slavery one, if you go back to something where we feel really distant to, so 2000 years, right? So no one can kind of blame us that. I remember reading about, I think it was the Babylonian king, and we have the as the code or the codex of Hammurabi. Yeah. And he specifically gave a price for slaves, right? I think it was 10 or 20 shekels, and female slaves were worth less than male slaves. And then you went up to like the equivalent of the middle class and gave specific values. And it was actually codified in law. So you would have been sort of breaking the law had you thought differently on that. Have you given even male and female slaves equality, you would have been not only extremely weird, but you would have actually been breaking the law and the thinking of that. And so 2000 years kind of seems almost incredibly long in some respects or not, but that is kind of how far we've evolved, at least in our social and moral thinking. But it was really obviously, I mean, we don't have very much evidence of that time, but we have it in the codex that obviously would have mean a lot of arguments for that time. Actually, that maybe that's quite a good segue into thinking about school. And I was wondering what you thought about homeschool or unschool or generally educational institutions, because your experience was quite different, but sort of growing up as a kind of Christian homeschooler, but I guess in a slightly more fundamentalist type of experience and way. But I think a lot of your essays have also been quite critical about the kind of institutional thinking you get in say a more mainstream type of schooling on that. So I was thinking, you know, what do you think about the advantages not of an unschool, homeschool type of thing and how it viewed you? And maybe there's some of this kind of more, I guess it's kind of critical thinking about the way we are, the way we have been, spring from actually having less kind of rules-based approach to learning that you might get in a more mainstream institution.
Yeah. Yeah, I you're right. I was homeschooled my entire childhood. Very isolated from the outside world. I only ever interacted with other homeschoolers. Like I didn't have this, like I didn't watch media with like public school in it very often, right? So like I didn't know anything about how school worked. And I remember when I was 14, I maybe mentioned this, I went to school for 3 months when my parents like tried out me going to public school. And there was like some really shocking things like that I didn't expect. Like one is the wasted time would probably be the top one. Is that I was shocked by like how much time it took to learn almost no information. Like at home, I would have learned all of like my entire school day in like an hour, maybe an hour and a half. And I was just like shocked by like, we just spent a lot of time waiting, walking around, hanging out. Like the teacher would like get ready to talk and the teacher would go very slowly through things. And I'd be like, holy shit, like I'm not learning anything basically. And in hindsight, I feel like the problem here is that it took away my free time. Like as a kid, I would do my homeschooling schedule in like a couple hours, like 4 to 5 days a week. And then I'd have the rest of the day 100% free to do what I wanted. And what I wanted to do was like awesome shit. Like I learned to juggle. I wrote a million words of fantasy fiction. I read nonstop. I like learned how to sew. I was like constantly creating because I had all of the spare time. And like, as an adult, when I look back on, you know, what was valuable about my childhood, I think about the shit I taught myself because that's the stuff I was really passionate about. And that's the stuff that like carried over to my adulthood. I think very little about the stuff that I learned that I was like required to learn that I didn't want to. And so like I'm horrified at public school because they take that away from kids. It's not just that they're like bad at teaching them, it's that they take away the ability for kids to teach themselves. It's so upsetting to me. Like, so I was homeschooled the whole time. I ended up getting out. And then shortly after I entered the normal adult world, I lived in a house with a bunch of other people who had gone to public school, which was, by the way, pretty culturally isolating because they all had this shared sort of understood history, like vocabulary, culture awareness I didn't have, but that's a different point. But hearing them like talk about their school experience made me increasingly grateful for mine. Like also the school social experience. Like it's really abnormal to have a bunch of kids like stratified by age group and have like almost no adults there or like older, younger kids present. Like with my upbringing, I always hang out with families. Like I was constantly exposed to other people's parents. We had like homeschooler times around Mondays, all of the families would get together and educate each other as like families. And so like, there was no opportunity for like weird social hierarchies to evolve like in your own tiny age range. It was like, in my opinion, it was much healthier. And so these people would talk about like getting bullied in school with like emotion stuff. You know, people like trying to become like the queen bee or, you know, having people insult you or like invite you to a party and laugh at you, like all of these like really traumatizing emotional experiences. I had never once been bullied by a fellow child at any point. I had never once had another kid be mean to me in my entire childhood. Maybe when I was like three and somebody stepped on my sandcastle. But like, and I saw like these emotional like traumas that my friends were carrying, like way more insecure in some ways than I was, which is saying something because I was a pretty insecure person. And like way more like oriented around their appearance. Like I have like sort of a really good relationship to my appearance, but they got bullied for it and picked on. It was like really important for them. And I went through my childhood, nobody really cared about appearance. So I don't have any of that fucking bullshit trauma that everybody else seems to have. And I think it comes straight from public school. I'm ranting a little bit because I feel very passionately about this. Public school seems like one of the worst things to like happen to humanity. It just like takes like the joy and the independence and the confidence and the love of learning out of children very systematically. And my childhood wasn't even good. I had abusive parents. Like my dad worked from home and we were homeschooled. So I was like stuck in a house with a monster like my entire childhood. And I still think that that was a better outcome than the shit that I see my friends go through with public school. There, I'm done with my rant. Thank you. Well,
that's I hope that was cathartic for you as well, but that's a very good advert for homeschool. And in fact, and you picked up on the last point, which was I wasn't sure about having such a kind of fundamental Christian, which you now kind of probably disagree with that part of the upbringing, but you said actually you probably would take that trade-off again, almost, you're saying, between a public school and you know, I guess not that sort of upbringing or the freedom that an unschool homeschool environment gave you. I think that's really fascinating. So yeah, I don't know about that. You think that's a sort of separate strand, you homeschool, regardless of whether you're brought up in a fundamental way or not, is just a better way of thinking. And I guess the fundamentals of public school or how we come about them, I guess, was a sort of Anglo-Saxon invention to get industrialized people, factory workers, to get read and write and have this kind of working class, middle class bit of when the schooling went, because the elite from 100 years ago or so still used family learning. Essentially, they had like a governor, governess, although you did also start to send children away to boarding school somewhat on that. So yeah, I think that's quite interesting. And your upbringing was very strictly religious, and you write about studying logical Christianity, but you lost your faith, and that was also quite painful. I was interested in whether that's changed, your reflection of that has changed over the time as you become more distant to it, and whether actually the kind of homeschool, unschool thinking, that freedom that you got to potentially think for yourself, actually helped unwind some of that. I know you kind of get told one way, you know, like gays are evil or whatever, so that doesn't compute, but that actually that's a little bit of freedom of thought that homeschool gives you kind of also opens the door to that way of thinking. So I don't know whether you'd reflect on losing your faith or how that came about, and and how that was for you.
Yeah, my upbringing was pretty anomalous, even among other Christian homeschoolers, because my dad was a professional evangelical Christian. So we were a little bit like more focused around like the intellectual defense of the Christian faith than other people. And I do think that like part of me losing the faith was genetics. Like, I think that I just got born with sort of a weird brain that is like more disagreeable and more open than most other people, which is like more likely to change your mind, I guess. And a lot of the people, the friends who I was brought up with, the majority of them are still very, very Christian and still in that life. So for me, I think I was abnormal. I think that like my dad specifically tried very hard to instill like good thinking in us, as far as he could. He was quite smart and taught us like logic stuff. Like some of my earliest memories are him like playing like logic games with us as kids. He'd be like, does a monkey have, or does like a cat have two legs? And I'd be like, no, he has four. And my dad would be like, yes, the cat has two legs and four. Like just like stuff like that to make sure that our thinking was like really crisp and precise. So I was like 4 years old, I swear. I was like, I was a child. And so I think that did help to some degree. There's some sort of like question everything, like definitely question everything. I remember having that from a very young age, being like, I was really taken by the concept that there were like other Muslim kids, because like the Muslims were the worst for us. There were like other Muslim kids being raised, you know, very similar to the way I was, and they were devout Muslims. And I was like, well, then I feel exactly the same way that they do. So how do I know that my faith is true and theirs isn't? Like, I have to cling to something beyond my sensation about this, like my conviction, because I think that was really helpful. Like part of the weird brain thing is like being very interested in like the way things feel for other people and like checking to see if that is the way that I also feel. And that was also really vital in losing my faith, because like somewhere in my brain, I had this constant like awareness that this might be wrong. And I think that's something that a lot of Christians don't have. And I was very lucky to end up with that.
Okay. That's really fascinating. Yeah. Almost you were given the seeds to, through all of that questioning, to actually unpick your own faith. Well, I mean, what would you say to others who might be on the verge of losing their faith?
I saw like a wave of like compassion and sadness for that. It's hard. Losing your faith is so hard. And I like respect it, because like you're losing a lot. It's like losing your comfort and your sense of direction and morality and society. And it's just, it means so much. And I think it's better on the other side of it. But I'm like if I had to say it, I'm like, I'm sorry that you have to go through that, would be my feeling.
But at least for you, it's better on the other side, even though it could be really painful going through it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's terrifying and scary, but it's great. It's great, I swear. At least for me, it's great. Some people have more trouble than I did. Some people have less, but yeah. It can be great.
But I guess there's light at the end of the tunnel, not to use the kind of heavenly metaphor for it, but yes. Yeah. Okay, and then you left home. You're in these kind of new digs and stuff. And I think you kind of went to work, and I read an essay, I think, which only briefly sort of talked about waking up at like even something like 4 a.m. or very early to going to work in a factory in quite a miserable type of job. And I'm not quite sure how long you did that for, but it seems like a significant amount of time, or it felt significant there. And I was just wondering, because that's kind of an insight into what a lot of Americans or a lot of people do in the world. And I think there's a lot of people who are born, you know, richer or listen to podcasts and stuff, who don't really ever get that sense of what it was really like to be, I guess what we kind of think, you know, really working class. You're working at kind of a minimum wage, hard living job. So I don't know whether you wanted to reflect on that experience and how that then shaped you into where you are now, or what it's like, or what people might not understand about what it's like to wake up at 4 a.m. and go to work in a factory.
Yeah, I had very low standards for my life at that point. I was like expected to become, you know, a housewife the cultural idea of what I would do with my life was not very grand. I was supposed to have children. And so like I didn't go to college, or I did like very, very briefly. And I didn't have a hope of like becoming a higher class person. So for me, getting a job, it was actually slightly above minimum wage, believe it or not. And that was very exciting for me. And at that point, I was going hungry because I didn't have enough money. And I was applying to every job. I was applying to jobs like working in the sewers, like to scoop poop. Like, so when I got a factory job, I was thankful because it was like a step up from what I was like prepared to do in order to live. So I got the factory job and I made the fucking best of it. I tried really hard to like it. I was like, I'm going to make my life good. I'm going to enjoy it. The thing is, we worked at a factory and we had got these trays with the units on it that we would assemble and then pass the tray. And the tray had a little pad on it. And so when I had like a couple seconds of downtime, I would like scratch little messages, because these pads got circulated throughout the factory and were seen by the other factory workers. But you had to just angle it just right, like at a certain light to be visible. So it was like a little bit of a hidden message. So I would do this. I would scratch these messages to the other factory workers. Like it was like that sort of thing. Like I really tried to make the best of it. But it was hard. It was really hard working weekends and waking up that early and working for like 10, sometimes 12 hours a day. It fucking sucked, man. It stretched even my ridiculous optimism. But some people there at the factory seemed to like it somehow, or maybe they just like were really good at emotionally handling it. I'm not sure. But I, during that time, during the spare moments I had, I was doing photography on the side, and I got like briefly employed by a photography job, which allowed me to quit my factory job. And then the photography job fired me because I was 19 and not good. And then after that, I was like, I can't go back to the factory job. I just can't make myself like go back, because like when I left on my last day, all my coworkers were like, good job for you. Go get them, go out into the world. Like you got out. And I just couldn't bear the thought of being like, I failed. So I did not do that. And then I ended up doing sex work after that.
Gosh, that almost feels slightly Hollywood film script. But on the factory work thing, it's kind of interesting because you do get some people, and I'm always a little bit, I'm not sure if this is really true, but people are doing this kind of low paid work. So the classic story is, I think, a janitor, or the janitor in the White House goes, I'm not just cleaning the corridors, I'm helping put a man on the moon. Or the cleaner cleaning toilets in a hospital says, you know what, I'm not just cleaning poop, I'm actually saving people's lives because of that, because you bring this purpose to your job. But it seems to me pretty rare. And actually, I almost wonder whether it's a kind of romanticization from other people who are not doing this, thinking, okay, this is what people can make or do of it. And actually, it's just either physically tiring or mind-numbing or both. And you have to do these kind of, I'm really interested that you have like a little piece of creativity, a little piece of something other, which kind of makes it human, which I hadn't quite fully appreciated in it. But it was obviously so, the economics is so poor, even though it was slightly above a minimum wage, which you thought on the one hand was really great, but it was too soul-destroying to go back to. Or do you think, had you not had that little step up to something better like a photography job, that maybe you would have, but it was that you feel you couldn't fall further back down the ladder?
Well, I didn't know how to get out. Like I had no idea how to do anything. I didn't know. I had zero like community, no network. I was completely unknown. I had no conception of like steps I could take to make my life better. I just knew that like I should just try. I think I was also very high risk. I was willing to take a lot of high risks, which helped. I'm not sure if that answers your question though.
Yeah, well, I guess it does. And I guess your next step is into escort and sex work, which I mean, the economics of it are so obviously so much better, but obviously comes with all of this kind of risk and everything. And I guess without it, you wouldn't be kind of where you are today with it. But it does seem like it's such a large sort of jump with that. But did you kind of feel like there was nothing else around that? Or was it just kind of a more expected value? Like, okay, this might be quite risky, but there seems like there's really high rewards. I could do this. Why not?
Oh, I didn't even think that far. It was mostly like, after I quit the thing, I moved like back down to Boise, which is like 5 hours away from the city that I was in working at the factory. And I was like, I wanted to figure out how to do my own thing. So I tried doing like photography. I tried doing like product photography, but I was like, again, fucking 19, no idea. I was homeschooled, no idea how the world works, no friend, like, or at least very new friends, like not a good community. So all of my attempts were really shit. And so I was living on a friend's couch, living off savings, like trying desperately to like make my own way, trying pretty poorly. Because I had vowed never to have a boss again. Like the factory was so terrible. I was like, hey, I want to make my own business somehow. I don't know how. I just can't do that. And then, so I tried a couple things, and then a friend suggested camming. And then I cammed my first night, made $60, which is fucking loads of money for me at the time. And I was like, oh my God, like this is a way. This is something I could pour my effort into and like get something out of it. And so I didn't have like long-term concepts at all. All I knew is that like for the first time I was like able to make money, like doing something that I was directing. So I threw myself at it full heart and soul.
Sure. Okay. So entrepreneurial spirit, kind of in charge of your own life and destiny, with all of that. I think it's kind of really interesting that you kind of came out, obviously to me, smart with lots of kind of critical thinking, homeschool skills, but then none of the other, because I guess what public schools would give you, or say, you know, West Coast or East Coast Shishi public schools, gives you that social capital and network that allows you to kind of use all of these other things, but that without it, it's actually really difficult to kind of use whatever smarts you might have. Like you refer to community loads of times. It's kind of really interesting. And then obviously you've got communities now, but coming out at 17, 18, 19, 20, you know, that lack of community means you didn't have that social capital to rely on.
Yeah, I should probably be a little bit more like precise or something. I was able to make friends, but there was a very strong cultural divide at that point. Like I had grown up completely within a separate set of media and separate set of social norms. And so it was very much like coming from a different country. Mm-hmm. And I remember like many times like hanging out around normal people and feeling like I was an alien, and there was no way I could explain it to them, because to them I looked the same, I talked the same, I had grown up in the town over. But there was like just like tiny little things about the way they interacted and like the words they used that I did not understand. I was like, there's some other thing going there. And I must have been very strange to them too. Like there was a lot of things that I did that were like, what the fuck? She's really weird. She's like not behaving like normal people behave. And to be clear, like I grew up with homeschoolers, and all the homeschoolers sort of behaved like that. So I was like I was really pretty socially good with homeschoolers, but it was like this transition to this new thing. And so that made it hard for me to develop friends that were good. And I think that's one of the reasons I was unable to keep my job as a photographer, is because my cultural norms were too different. Like I'd been raised to be extraordinarily submissive. And they needed somebody who was like able to say no to people and like able to like be like confident and sort of like engage with people who like might have different wants. And I was unable to do that. I had that beaten out of me. So it's just like stuff like that, right? So when I say community, I don't mean that like I was unable to like go to meetups and make friends. It was just that it was like constant handicap.
Well, I guess there's two things there, because on the one hand, it's speaking a different cultural language, but on the other hand, it's also that your character was shaped in a way that it wasn't able to fit into this new culture so easily. Right. And I guess the both points are were difficult for you. But but you learned this new language, and like did it take you? Because it sounded like it took you quite long to sort of fit into like the non fundamental Christian individual Christian world. But that came through, so like your character changed and your understanding of this new world changed. I mean, was that a years long process, or did you have a sort of like two or three aha type moments? I guess this comes on to like creation and invention. Like, is it sort of small incremental innovation, or do you kind of like have moments where it all kind of crystallizes together, which loops into a little bit like enlightenment or LSD or things? Is it constant almost meditation? Do you get there through prayer, or do you have this aha moment where you think, oh my God, this is, you know, this is another force beyond which speaks to me?
I like the analogy. For me, it was really incremental. And I think it took about 7 years until I no longer had that feeling of like being a stranger. Now I still get it. I get like little flashes every now and then, but it's like very pretty rare. But I think it was around 25, because I left home when I was 17. And it was when I was 25 years old that I noticed, like, oh, I don't really feel like I'm an outsider anymore. So about that long. And it was very slow.
All right. Okay. So you still spent more years as a kind of a feeling as an outsider than as an insider then, really.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. It's kind of just thinking about, you know, life journey and course. Okay. Yeah. Well, here's one of your own questions, which I thought was really interesting because I didn't really know how to answer it quite. And so I'm still thinking about it. So this is the one when you go, you're in a room with, say, 10,000 people, maybe 1,000 people, and you get to ask three binary questions. So yes, no. And so for each question, the people who answer the question according to what the way you want, they stay, and the people who don't leave the room. So I don't know if you've ever asked yourself this question, but what are the three questions that you ask people?
Oh, yeah, I had like a really good set of answers to these that I forget, but I'll try and generate some, but they're not going to be as good. I think probably one is free will. One's one of my favorite questions. Like, do you believe that we have free will or not? And my preferred answer is no. So I would take those people. Maybe something about like sense of self, like where's your sense of self located? That's not a yes, no question. I'd have to think more specifically.
And what's the correct answer? Sense of self in yourself or outside of yourself? Is that the idea?
Because that's the thing. I feel like something in that direction about sense of self. Maybe like the location isn't quite right, but there's like some sort of like malleable sense of self, or like it's like the sense of kind of being a character on a stage in a play.
And you're acting it out. Yes, that's one of your questions.
I like that a lot. And I find that I really bond well with people there. And then maybe like, have you ever changed your mind on something really drastic, like really huge, like fundamental to who you are?
Maybe? I guess that, and the answer you're going to want is yes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are your answers to that question?
Oh, I don't know. I keep on thinking about it. Now I'm riffing on your free will one, but I guess that's it. So if there isn't one, that's kind of like a destiny, but it kind of feels like almost the same as your second question. Cause that is, I think, how do you class it? I think I've taken this from a survey where you say life is a story, a game, and we have Don characters to play it. Billionaires play the game of money. Religious fanatics play the game of heaven and hell. People who watch their children die play the game of grief, and that we're all playing parts. But if that's true, that's kind of almost true that you don't really think there's free will if we're all playing these kind of character games and parts in it. So I think that's a double question. You're going to not lose that many people. I guess mine is to do with kind of mindsets, would be with things like curiosity, or curiosity and open-mindedness would be one. And then if I'm going to hang out with these people, so it depends like how you're using this, would there be something to do with like liking sort of food or conversational culture, like could we have a good party together, that type of thing? But I'm not sure exactly what it would be, because I don't think I necessarily party well with everyone. And then I don't know what my last one would be. I'd have to still think about it. It might be something to do with love of travel, which is kind of like a lot of come of this, or, you know, maybe have an opportunity, but this idea of wanting to visiting places or go places, because particularly when I was younger, I traveled a lot, and I think it's been really influential. And I think people still now don't travel enough, or they make pronouncements about things which they really don't have any idea of, because they either have no lived experience or they haven't gone there, which is like your point you made way back about, you know, rooting where we were in history and what the kind of pros and cons of an idea debated on that time. And so what's one I was really fascinated about your working in a factory. So I've never worked in something like that, but I did stay on an open cast gold mine in Borneo in East Malaysia when I was about 17. And that was quite eye opening. I don't know whether it was like a completely dramatic, I held something really close to me and then it changed. But I think I definitely had that slightly, what I would call it, paternalistic view that, oh, I know better than these poor people who live in villages with no running water. And like, this must be the way you should think and do to do better. And then when I went to stay with these people, it was like, know what? You know, you're completely rational. This is exactly what you would do if, like, you have no running water, you'd find a job. Like, you know, literally you are pooing in a hole you were digging like that week, it really changes your mind. You have no credit card or family to get you out of that. And this is your whole life ahead of you. And many of you will, you know, you're very likely to die young, right? So why would you bother with a pension if actually you thought there was a higher than 50% chance you're going to die before you're 60? You just wouldn't. And so actually that kind of really did change my life, like staying on this gold mine and speaking to people and traveling around there was like, and I was traveling by myself. It's like, okay, my worldview was kind of wrong because I made these assumptions without, I think you could have got there if you really thought very hard about what it was like to actually live there. But most of us, I would maybe say maybe all of us, that's such a leap of imagination if it's very far apart from the world that you've lived in, that you can't do it unless, it's very hard to imagine living for 2 weeks without running water unless you've actually ever really lived without running water and had to dig your own toilet. It's just such a different way of being. And that's a little bit like you're saying, like going back 150 years ago, like they had no running water and, you know, all of that. The time of it was very different.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that chimes with what you were saying. Okay, so perhaps now a little section on underrated, overrated, or you could just do like a little commentary about what you might think about this item coming up. If you're happy to play this game. So underrated, overrated, or you can pass, or you could just make a commentary on it. So okay. Underrated, overrated, the accordion.
Underrated. It's underrated.
Okay, and why is it underrated?
Beautiful instrument.
And why is it underrated? What don't we understand about accordion or accordion playing?
Well, it's like accordions tend to play a type of music which is very like goofier oriented. Mm-hmm. Or French, you know, something like that. But I've
folk
found
music,
that.
I guess.
Excuse me?
Folk music, folksy music, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but it feels like a great thing to play for a lot of different types of music. I find it to be also like capable of like great sadness, which I really enjoy that. And also like it feels like it vibrates your body when you play it, and it in a way that like piano doesn't, for example, or like a flute. So it's like sort of like more, you're like closer, like almost like you're breathing with your instrument, which I find to be really wonderful.
Cool. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Ballroom dancing or other social dancing like this?
Underrated.
Another underrated one. They're not going to be all underrated. Maybe. Well, we'll see.
Yeah, ballroom dance is totally underrated. I think it's because it takes a lot of effort to learn, but man, it's so worth it. I think that like people don't understand how fucking fantastic it can feel to be good at it.
Well, here in the UK, we are very obsessed by this program called Strictly Dancing. I don't know if you've got a US equivalent, but like the country's been mad about it for years and years. So there's actually quite a big ballroom dancing culture, and even to some quite, because you don't associate it with young people, right? But actually there's quite a lot of young people who will do that, or at least learn like a little bit, partly because of Strictly. And actually Strictly's been quite groundbreaking recently, because they've like introduced, you know, it, like age or thoughts of ageism, and then also kind of like you know, gender and identity, like should you have same sex or not in your dancing and things. So it's kind of been weirdly progressive in what's considered a not necessarily progressive art form. But anyway, UK is a bit obsessed by it.
Well, it's interesting. Social dancing in general is like weirdly progressive. So in the US we have a lot of social dancing, but it tends to be blues and fusion, not a lot of young people doing the ballroom specifically. So I might have to check out in the UK. But the scene is like very progressive compared to others, and I suspect it's because you end up being physically in close contact with strangers, which like tends to select for like more of the poly or sexually fluid crowd, who are like less uncomfortable switching like physical contact, is my guess, my theory.
Yeah, I guess. And I guess that culturally or whatever, a lot of gay people have also been into this type of dancing, and particularly in the UK, actually, ballroom's been identified with that and performance and things. Okay. Underrated, overrated, or commentary, pronouns.
Are pronouns underrated? Like pronouns in general, or are you referring to like they, them pronouns?
Well, you can choose.
I can choose. In generally, I feel like pronouns are exactly as rated as they should be.
All right. And they, them, him, her, or identity pronouns, z's, I, z.
Yeah, it depends on your culture. If you're in a conservative culture, I think they're underrated. And if you're in a liberal culture, I feel like they're overrated.
Okay. Yeah. Overused in some, not appreciated in others. Okay. That is fair. Abalone, overrated or underrated?
You pronounced it right, even. Wow. Great. It's a great game. For I assume people don't know what the game is. It's an abstract strategy board game with marbles. It's very fast and easy to learn, and it's awesome. It's one of my favorite games.
Very good. Okay, so this is a weird one, which I picked up on your site, which was then sweating or sweating on command. What's that about?
No, that one is definitely overrated.
Right, okay.
I have hyperhidrosis.
Okay.
A condition where my hands and feet sweat excessively. I'm sick of it. I would like it to stop. Oh, but I can do it on command, unfortunately.
Oh, can you? So you know... that's cured by Botox.
I tried that. Oh, I went to get Botox injections in my palm. Turns out shoving a needle into all the parts of your palm and fingers,
quite painful,
like 30 times, it is excruciating. I do not recommend it.
Okay. And actually, I might have picked up, have you a little bit needle phobic or no, not really?
Well, very needle phobic.
Yeah, 30 is not going to, do it for you then.
I loaded up on anti-anxiety meds for that, and so which helped a lot, but still the pain was horrific.
Yeah, I happen to know a derm who's as a friend, and so we were talking about, she gets quite a lot of patients for sweating, because actually also in the armpit, because it can stop sweating there. But she said mild to moderate pain. I will go back to her and say, like, no, I've spoken to someone who...
Not in the palm. Dude, it's in every part of the finger. Like, you know, the sections of your finger, like, it's like three in each finger. Like, one on the base, one in the middle, one on the tip. Every finger. It's not mild to moderate pain. She's crazy.
Well, I guess she's talking her own book here. Okay. Well, that's actually most of that I had on underrated and overrated. So we just had a couple more of your own questions here. So one was, I guess I paraphrase this, is what do you make of emotional pain? And are there things that you would do where it was a lot of emotional pain, but you would go through them again?
What do I make of it? Well, I generally like emotional pain and sometimes seek it out intentionally. I suspect a lot of people do this to some degree, like when you watch tragic movies and then you cry, like that's a very intentional seeking out of emotional pain. But there's some sort of acceptance of it that I really value. And I suspect a lot of other people would like it too, if they could get it.
And I guess this seeking out sort of emotion thing. So I was interested in your essay on circling, which to be honest, I'd never really come across. And I don't think I would probably try myself. I'm not sure what I would get out of it, but it seems like you did. And there also there are different forms of circling, which I hadn't appreciated either, but you seem to get quite a lot out of it. But that some of that to me seems part of it is mindfulness, but part of it is kind of seeking a kind of an emotional or emotionality and a connection. I mean, what is circling for you? Is that right? Or have I read that wrong? And why is it? Why do you like it?
I think it stands out of the curiosity. Like circling is incredibly novel. It's one of like the highest density novel experiences that I regularly get stuff out of. Like I go and I'm regularly surprised by the things that people say and react and do in a way that I'm not surprised in normal conversations. This podcast thing is like really wonderful. And I've been like mildly surprised a few times by some of the things you say, but it's not like I'm like losing my mind, right? Yeah. Like, so like even in like really great conversations, there's a sort of norm about like how many like novel things are said. But with circling, it's like almost everything said. I'm like, what? And then it triggers like a lot of reactions in me because the practice is to pay very close attention to what is triggered inside of you. So a lot of it is like somebody says something and I have like a big reaction inside me and I'm curious about that and I get to look at it. So it's been just like a highest information for me.
Okay, that's interesting. And so it's very self-awareness on that. Well, next time I'm going to come up with even weirder questions, but I guess this is also people listening in think, oh, that is slightly too weird. Okay. And a couple of the other ones then would be, who do you hate most?
My dad, probably.
Okay.
I don't like hate him very much anymore because I've mostly gotten over it. So I wouldn't actually describe it as hating him, but like if I had to say the most, then maybe, yeah.
Okay. And are you afraid of death? Why or why not?
Sometimes. If you put me near a cliff, I'm extremely afraid of death. Okay. If you drive me really fast in a car, I am extremely afraid of death. There's some other way which I'm like ready though.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that might be, that's interesting because they feel like dangerous things that you might not actually be scared of death, but of the actual activity. Although, like you say, you like some other high risk activities. I'm developing a show about death, partly because I don't think we think about it enough. So I'm kind of interested in that enlightenment and stuff. But it does seem strange that we, at least today, like versus 100, 150 years ago, death was really present. You know, we actually, obviously the pandemic now, more of us know people who have died. But 100 years ago, you would have, by the time you were 20, 30, 40, seen loads of people die, would have been a normal part of your life, which particularly in richer countries, it isn't. So I think that's one of the reasons that we have become more afraid of death in general. Mm-hmm. Anyway, okay, last couple of questions then for you are, what are your favorite questions? Do you have questions that you really like asking or questions of the moment that are really kind of preying on your mind?
I like, one of my favorites is like, what is your most controversial opinion according to the people in this room or like your peer group or whatever, depends on the context I'm asking. But that's one of my favorites because like it requires the person to one, like make a guess about what the people around them are like, and which is often wrong. Like you'd be surprised at how bad people are at predicting what people will find controversial. And two, like requires them to like sort of set themselves apart from the other people there. Which is people like pick different methods of doing it, and they're all really fascinating. That's one of my favorites, I think.
Yeah. Okay. That's really interesting. So you've got to, because you kind of got to know the room or your people, and I guess if they're your friends, it couldn't be surprising that you might not know your friends as well as you think you do.
Mm-hmm. And it's also asking you to take like a bold social stand. Like it's asking you to like literally figure out what the thing most of the people in the room will think you're like wrong about. So it's like an emotionally charged thing to do as well.
Sure. And what sort of research or work are you doing at the moment? So you've got kind of like the Enlightenment essays on, still kind of going. There seems to be something you're still interested in, kind of synesthesia, kinesthesia. You're doing a lot of research, I guess, still on collecting data on questions and escorts and that type of thing. What are you most interested in your projects at the moment?
Kinks. Is another big subject that I'm like preparing to do maybe a set of essay or surveys on. Basically like sexual fetishes. I've already done a couple on them, but like I want to go like deeper and more precise. What causes them? Like that's a big one. Like are people like abuse in childhood? Does that make kinks happen? Is it like random, unpredictable? What about birth order? Just a bunch of stuff like that.
Okay. And I had to pause for a second there because I thought you said pinks with a P, not kinks with a K. I was like, what are pinks? It's like, oh, I haven't heard of this one. This is going to be that. But that was normal. Okay, cool. And then I guess with your life now, you've talked about going back a little bit into sex work. And there seemed to be a period when you were sort of suggesting, oh, it's a real shame that, you know, my questions or my other things that I could do are just not as economically satisfying either. I mean, do you feel that that's a tension of where you'd be? Like you'd prefer to be running like, you know, a VC firm or entrepreneurial thing, or actually the way you compartmentalize your life, are you relatively happy about how things are working out?
I'm relatively happy. I'm not like fully happy. I'm extremely fortunate and grateful for the opportunities that I have. I also would love to just get paid to do research. That's my dream. I just want to like not think about the sex work thing. Like it's fine. It's just not, I don't like get a thrill out of taking like literally like the 5,000th photo of my breasts. Like it's kind of boring. I really want to solve problems, right? I want to solve problems and figure out like knowledge that we haven't figured out before. That's my real passion. I'm hoping to take steps in that direction. I'm working on founding a research institute for sex stuff specifically. And I'm hoping to get funding, which might happen. We'll see.
So yeah, anyone interested in grant funding or anything for that, do you get in touch? Or I guess you could get, so I mean, this is interesting, this kind of, you know, maybe you'll get someone from crypto world or a crypto bro who's kind of interested in different things. And like, I haven't really seen it open up funding ideas. There's a little bit, I guess, in the kind of what I would call the Tyler Cowen Tylerverse, and there's a little bit of funding, little cover, interesting streams there. But I don't think we're funding things radically different. And again, actually, if you go back 100-150 years ago, there were many different ideas about how we should fund things or get things going. And now we've got a bit of university funding, and then you've obviously got the Silicon Valley thing. Mm-hmm. But for stuff which is kind of really interesting, but maybe not that commercial and not coming out of a university, it still strikes me as harder to fund than it should be. So
right.
Anyway, I hope that catches and you get someone to give you lots of funding for that. Okay. And then last question would be, do you have any advice for people in general? So like kind of the life advice that you've thought, either, I guess, people who might want to make a career in this kind of thing, or, you know, you've sort of thinking, you know, what you think, advice that you'd have for people in how they might think about living their lives.
That's such a large question. That's huge. Maybe I should see if that would be a good ask all question, because it's just so big. If I had to, it would be like focus on asking the right question, maybe. Like probably if your life isn't going the way you want, then you probably haven't asked the right question yet. Something in that direction.
That's very on brand. Asking the right question is your one big thing. Okay. That actually makes sense. Mine is often about curiosity and open-mindedness, and that's a similar sort of thing, that asking the right question. I wonder whether you also need the counterpoint is you need to ask the right question, but you also need to be sensitive to listening, because if you're not listening to the conversation and answers that you're having, and which is maybe part of your circling thing, that actually you might have asked the right question, but you didn't hear the answers that you wanted to hear, or the answers which were actually already available to you. And so you missed it. Cool.
Yeah. Would it be something like performative asking? Like if you ask, but you're not really interested in the answer or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. There's that. Or particularly in British English speak, we've got a lot of things where we don't really mean what we say. So the classic one is if a British English person says, "with all due respect," and then says something, "with all due respect" is completely the opposite. They only say that when they think you are really, really stupid. So we say, "with all due respect," if you hear that from a British English person, that, oh no, they think we're completely, completely stupid. And we've got loads of these terms. This is talking about the cultural difference, actually. Americans often find it quite difficult. So they come in and they went, "with all due respect," "oh, they must have like respected my opinion." And this is the kind of example is, no, no, no. We only say that if you're, this is like the rock bottom, and this is like the step below. I'd probably be better if we were like swearing at you. This is like the lowest of the low, is like, "with all due respect," just means
you're, I did such not a, know that.
Yeah, you're such a total idiot that I'm not even saying anything. That's how we use it. And another is the way we say quite good or not bad. So when we say quite good, we don't mean actually that was moderately good to even quite good. We normally mean that was pretty bad. And when we say not bad, we actually normally mean quite good, pretty good. So it's really confusing for Americans who come, particularly in office environments with British workers. They'll go, "Yeah, that was quite good." No, that was not good at all. Where we say on the offhand, not bad. Actually, that means, you know what? Keep going. That was really good, and you should try that. So there is this cracking the cultural code. That was why I thought that was very true. What you're saying is coming out of where, whatever culture you are, and then implanted as someone who's been through public schools, and all of these really small, subtle things in word, how you might use your cutlery, what you even think of fast food and all of that, all of it is alien. And so you're speaking the same words, but you're speaking a different cultural language. And it's very obvious to those who are not in that cultural language that they didn't understand that, with the classic one, like "with all due respect," which is not with respect at all.
Oh.
Great. So is there anything else? What is the question that I should have asked you?
Oh, geez. I think you hit like really fantastic ones. I'm not sure I could do better than you've already done.
Well, that is a very good place to end with. So thank you very much for speaking with me.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is really lovely. I appreciate your time.
Great. Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
If you appreciate the show, please like and subscribe, as it helps others find the podcast.